There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the House of Cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today. In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's medical emergency kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And hello once again, friends. Welcome to another installment of Strange Planet. And if you'd like to get a little deeper into Strange Planet, you might want to consider becoming a premium subscriber. It's real easy to do. Just click on the link in the episode description, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. You gain access to commercial-free listening, special bonus episodes, 2 per month, produced exclusively for premium subscribers, and you also receive my monthly newsletter, Inner Sanctum, strangeplanet.supportingcast.fm. Bob Marley, One Love, opened in movie theaters in February. The biopic stars Kingsley Benadire as Bob Marley, the legendary pioneer of reggae music, and Lashana Lynch as Rita Marley, and James Norton as record producer Chris Blackwell, the founder of Island Records. One Love not only focuses on Marley's music, but also on his social and political impact, which includes the politically motivated assassination attempt on Bob and his wife by 7 gunmen back in December of 1975. Of course, Bob Marley would live on for a few more years before dying of cancer in May of 1981 at the age of 36. His battle with cancer began with a very rare form of a fast-growing and hard-to-diagnose melanoma under the nail of the big toe on his right foot. And unfortunately, had Bob agreed to an amputation when he was diagnosed in 1977, he may still be alive. But because of his Rastafarian beliefs about the sanctity of the body, he chose other treatments. Unfortunately, they did not work. However, There are those who maintain that his cancer was induced and implanted in his body by the CIA. And according to this theory, the CIA was concerned about Marley's power to the people influence and declared him a threat to U.S. interests in the Caribbean. Well, we're going to separate the wheat from the chaff regarding the legend of Bob Marley. Jim Bergenstadt has been dubbed the rock and roll detective. Jim has spent a lifetime researching and writing and consulting in pop music history. His books on the unreleased recordings of the Beatles, Black Market Beatles, and the making of Nirvana's seminal album, Nevermind, are critically acclaimed. Jim has served as a consultant to the Beatles' Apple Corps, George Harrison, the Traveling Wilburys, the band Garbage, and many international labels. He's currently the co-star of two pop culture TV series on The Reels channel, Celebrity Legacies and Celebrity Damage Control. And as a founder of Rock and Roll Detective, Jim's firm offers a number of specialized and confidential services to music artists and record labels. Jim, welcome back to Strange Planet. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Richard. Thanks for having me on. And what a wonderful introduction.
First of all, you've seen Bob Marley, One Love. Your thoughts? Do you want to give us a quick review of this biopic?
Yeah, I thought it was a good film. I think that especially for people who are just first coming to Bob Marley, it's a good introduction not only to him, but his spiritual beliefs, which are brought to the fore. And also, I would have to say the soundtrack is sort of a greatest hits of Bob Marley. And what's interesting is that you can also see in the film the creative evolution of some of these songs and figure out or see where they came from. So I found it very enjoyable. I think a lot of young people who didn't grow up with Bob Marley will enjoy it.
Can you talk to me about Marley's, you mentioned the sort of the evolution of the music, but Marley's role in the evolution of reggae music? When did it start and how did he take that form and build on it?
You know, I'm not a reggae historian, so I really can't, you know, I can't go into any great detail. I just know that as a teenager, he started working with other people to form a band. And, you know, they eventually made their way to a small studio, which you actually see in the film. But aside from that, I can't really give you that origin. I focused in my book, Mysteries in the Music, Case Closed, on the conspiracy theory related to the CIA and Bob Marley.
All right. So let's get into, let's maybe create kind of a backdrop here and take a look at what was happening in Jamaica, kind of a violent period in the 1970s, when you had these political parties and sort of their armed wings or almost militias, street militias that they had squaring off against each other. What was happening?
Well, to take one half step back before we get to those sort of gangs, I think it's important to understand the socio-political activity that was happening at the time. The United States had a lot of multinational corporations at the time that were in need of a bauxite, which is an aluminum ore used to create aluminum products. So you had the Alcoas and other big corporations that needed a lot of this bauxite ore. And the Caribbean happened to be the place where they could mine a lot of this ore in a very inexpensive way, paying pretty low wages to people on those islands. 60% of their ore was coming from the Caribbean islands, and a majority of that was coming from Jamaica. So what happened was a new prime minister, Prime Minister Manley, came in, and his party was called the PNP, and it was a party that was really moving towards socialism and away from capitalism. And so, and he had been involved in the Bauxite Union in Jamaica as a young man. So when he took over, he made some moves to nationalize it and take it away from the take it away from these corporations, or at least make them pay a lot more. First thing they did was they had to give up 51% ownership of these mines back to Jamaica. And then later the taxes went up on them and other such things. So that, of course, that coupled with the fact that Prime Minister Manley was visiting with Castro and having Castro advisors come over from Cuba, we began to fear as a country that Jamaica was heading towards communism. And if that was the case, too, these corporations would ultimately lose their ability to mine this, nearby inexpensive ore. So right. they lobbied Washington. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger went over there. He tried to offer financial aid to Jamaica and other such exchanges in consideration for the Prime Minister to basically move away from democratic socialism and back towards capitalism. It didn't work. Manley sent him home. Later, within a month, the United States discontinued any approval of loans to Jamaica. And then suddenly the ambassador's office, which only had a U.S. ambassador in Jamaica and his secretary, suddenly had seven new diplomats that joined them. And it turns out they were all CIA operatives. So their job was to basically disrupt the country and try to create so much violence and havoc in Jamaica that Manley would lose the next election to the more conservative candidate that the United States supported at the time. And his name was Edward Ciega. And so these two groups or gangs, as you mentioned, the JLP, which was Ciega, and the PNP, all started to battle, and the CIA was bringing weapons into Jamaica, smuggling them in and getting them to the JLP. And so it became a very violent clash between these groups over politics.
And were they both, the JLP and Michael Manley's PNP, were they both courting Bob Marley? Because obviously he was a very popular figure, hugely popular in Jamaica. Were they both courting him for his influence?
Well, initially, and really since he had grown up, Bob Marley had friends in both of those political groups. And although he probably leaned a little bit towards Prime Minister Manley, publicly, he always remained neutral. And in 1976, when he saw all his violence taking place, he felt, and he was aware of the, he was aware that the CIA was trying to disrupt Jamaica. He felt that the best way to deal with that is to put on a peaceful concert, which was ultimately called Smile Jamaica. And the reason why I believe Marley knew about the CIA is because he actually recorded a song that year that basically spoke to we don't want no CIA telling Rasta what to do, that type of thing.
Right.
And so it was fun because I was able to dig up previously classified documents to discover really what was going on behind the scenes with our government and how they were trying to manipulate the next election.
Let me ask you, how difficult was that to do? You're doing FOIA requests, I guess, Freedom of Information Act requests. Were you getting cooperation, or were you getting back a lot of heavily redacted documents?
I got no cooperation. I wrote a letter to, first of all, I discovered that those documents had been declassified 10 years before I started to request them. So the first time I sent off a FOIA letter, it was to the Obama administration, and their letter back to me said, we can neither confirm nor deny whether we have any documents that relate to Bob Marley and the CIA, which means we have them and you can't have them. You can sue us So I'm not going to waste time doing that. Then when time and money, you know, it could have been, I'd still be in litigation over that. So then when Donald Trump came into power as president, I wrote another FOIA request. I got back the exact same letter from his administration. We can neither confirm nor deny whether we have Bob Marley CIA records. So I thought that was interesting. Two different political parties in the U.S., neither one would give me documents that are supposed to be available to the public. So I then happened to have an opportunity to interview Colonel Oliver North, who had been the national security advisor under Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, before I asked him about those records, I asked him if he'd had an opportunity to talk to President Ford, who was president at the time all this CIA stuff was going on. And he did have that opportunity. And I said, well, why is it that I can't get these records? And he said, both presidents that you've written off to, both administrations should have given you those records. And, you know, we'll take a lot of time and money to sue them. But he said, have you heard of this website called WikiLeaks? And I laughed and said, yes, I have. And he said, the records are there. You'll find them. And so that's how I was able to get records that our own government should have released to me by law because they had been declassified. And so it was a fun story.
And what did the WikiLeaks documents reveal about the CIA's concern, particularly about Bob Marley? Did they have a big file on Marley?
They actually did not. Their main focus was on Prime Minister Manley, who, of course, was a political person in power who had been elected, duly elected. And they considered him to be the big problem in Jamaica. In fact, I did not find any active surveillance or reference to Bob Marley at all in 1976 until they put in there's a daily report that the president receives from the CIA every day about things going on around the world. So in December, after Bob Marley had been shot and went off to the hospital, the CIA records reflect them reading the Jamaican newspaper and basically reporting hearsay of this is what happened. There was the shooting and Bob Marley went to the hospital. It doesn't talk about any activity on their part, but that's where, when I was able to get those documents earlier, it listed the names of these phony diplomats, but real CIA agents. And I found one who was the secretary to the ambassador. That was his fake title. And his real title was chief of station of the CIA, which meant he was the top dog handling this operation. So I located him in the South, we'll say, of the United States, and he's long retired. And first thing I asked him was, so is it true that you were the secretary to the ambassador? And he said, yeah. And I said, is it also true that you were acting as the chief of station of the CIA? And he said, well, how can I answer that question without incriminating myself? And I said, you just did. So it was interesting to talk to him about what was going on with Manley, what was going on with Bob Marley, et cetera. So.
All right, we'll take a quick time out. Jim Birkenstadt, the rock and roll detective, the author of Mysteries in the Music, Case Closed. There is a chapter on Bob Marley, and that's what we're discussing, of course. Also the author of The Beatle Who Vanished, Nevermind Nirvana. And we'll talk about some of Jim's latest projects as well. Take a quick time out. Back with more of our conversation right here on Strange Planet.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. We're now crossing a zone of turbulence. Please return your seats and food trays to their upright position and make sure your carry-on luggage is safely stowed. You're about to leave everything you know behind. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Strange Planet.
And we are back with Jim Bergenstadt. Rockandrolldetective.com is the website. The link is in the episode notes, rockandrolldetective.com. And again, Mysteries in the Music, Case Closed, The Beatle Who Vanished, Nevermind, Nirvana, and Black Market Beatles. We're talking about Bob Marley and this persistent legend or theory, conspiracy theory, that the CIA were responsible for the cancer that ultimately led to Bob Marley's death in 1981. So let's get back to Smile Jamaica, this concert that was in the works. And as I understand it, Marley was very, again, aware of the, you know, the political tension, trying to walk this fine line, not to be perceived as being pro-PNP or Michael Manley or, you know, aligned with the JLP, the opposition. But somehow, one of these two political parties kind of glommed on to Smile Jamaica and Bob Marley and sort of took ownership of it. Can you explain how that happened?
Yes. Prime Minister Manley, who was the head of the PNP party, had to approve this concert. And so Bob Marley went to him and explained to him that he wanted this to be a completely non-political concert, just to sort of bring people together, peace, love, you know, the whole thing. And he got the permission from Prime Minister Manley. And then without his knowledge, when the posters came out, and in fact, the poster is illustrated in my book, Mysteries in the Music. When the poster came out, it said Bob Marley in conjunction with the Prime Minister's cultural blah, blah department present the Smile Jamaica concert. So this really angered the JLP party headed up by Edward Siega. And in fact, it's funny because the PNP were running around painting his name, but painting his name as CIA Ega, so that people got the impression that he was connected to the CIA or understood that. Anyway, they were very angered by this because they felt that Bob had betrayed this alleged neutrality. But in fact, it was real neutrality, and Bob was sort of taken by, you know, surprise over that. So two to three days before the concert, first thing that happened was Prime Minister Manley announced that he was going to have an election about 5 days after the concert. So it was all very clear how he was lining things up. And then 2 days before the concert, Bob Marley and the Wailers were rehearsing at his home in Jamaica. And something like seven very young, you know, 17-year-olds came in blasting guns all over the place, spraying the rehearsal room. And Bob stood still, didn't even move. And he caught a bullet in the elbow, but his manager had just come in, Don Taylor, and he walked into the kitchen and he was facing Bob, but his back was to that door he just came in. And this teenager just stuck his gun around the door. It wasn't really well represented in the film, but in reality, from actual eyewitness accounts, he stuck his gun in without even looking and just pulled the trigger several times. He hit Bob in the elbow, but he put five bullets in the back of Don Taylor, the manager.
Who miraculously lived. Who miraculously survived.
So that happened. And then after, and also Rita Marley was just leaving in her car. She got shot in the back of the head. She survived. And, the Marley group, once they left the hospital, went up to this mountain retreat owned by Chris at Island Records.
Chris Blackwell, yeah.
So they had to decide whether or not Bob should do the concert. And really, it was up to Bob. But he was receiving advice from both sides of the coin. One is you're exposing yourself to being shot again if you go up on that stage. There's no way to really protect you at a concert. And the other side of it was coming from Jeff Walker, who was public relations man for both Marley and Island Records. And he was saying, well, you really don't want to disappoint all these people who are planning to attend. It's thousands of people. It's still your concept of doing a peaceful concert to bring people together. It's very important. He also had an ulterior motive, which was Bob had an album out called Rastaman Vibrations. And Bob wasn't going to be touring at all in the fall of 76 or going into early 77. So Walker needed a way to get Bob Marley and that album in front of American record buyers, which was, of course, their big fan base there. So in those days, the only way to do that was to get you on television, such as Saturday Night Live or there's some midnight rock show.
Don Kirshner's rock concert and the Midnight Special.
Yeah. So you were trying to get clips onto those shows, yeah. Midnight Special, right? And so he did want this concert to go on. And what's interesting is the cameraman hired to do the principal filming was named Carl Colby. Mm. And Carl Colby, coincidentally, was the son of William Colby, who had just been fired by Gerald Ford about 12 months earlier.
Head of
the
CIA.
He really wasn't the head of CIA anymore.
Right.
But that's the sort of thing that starts conspiracy theories when people connect dots that might not necessarily be connected. According to Jeff Walker, Bob Marley knew that Colby's dad was CIA. Everyone in Marley's group knew it. Jeff Walker was with Colby the entire time. He wasn't off shooting up Bob's house or anything like that. And in fact, if you are involved in a CIA assassination, and I lay this all out in the book, there have been former CIA agents who list what the 10 principles are of a good CIA assassination, from who the target should be to after you are involved in it, you get out of that country immediately. So the idea that Carl Colby somehow had something to do with it and he hung around and chatted with Bob and then filmed Bob when Bob ultimately went down to the concert, it's kind of laughable as a conspiracy theory.
Right. So were the GLP, though, connected to the shooting? Was that ever established?
Based on the people I spoke to who were around Bob at that time, and I'm trying to think. Yeah, I came to the conclusion, and I set forth in the book, that the GLP gang, their main gang leader was a guy named Claude Massup. But he had been put in jail, conveniently, by Prime Minister Manley for owning a gun. And so he wasn't around. And so the second in command, whose nickname was James Brown, he, I think, wanted to, boost his credibility and perhaps take over the gang. So he felt that the thing to do would be to send a message to Bob and go in there and shoot up the place. And, you know, given the information about how CIA targets are assassinated, given the fact that President Ford had just signed a bill that prohibited the CIA from assassinating people anymore. And he knew that he wanted to, he already had trouble with his legacy because he had pardoned Richard Nixon when he became president. So I don't think that he would have wanted to go out with a legacy of having shot the most popular reggae entertainer in the world either.
Right, right.
And in fact, that was confirmed by Oliver North, who spoke to him about this. So it seems like it was a gang hit to try to boost the credibility of this James Brown.
So the concert that takes place a couple days later True or false, Bob Marley still had the bullet in his elbow when he performed?
True.
Wow.
He felt that if the bullet was removed, then it might have affected his guitar playing. And so he preferred to play with pain. And in fact, he never had that bullet removed.
Wow.
And that led to some other theory about lead poisoning killing him. But in fact, a doctor did a full review of all of his recently, did a full review of all of his medical records and said he definitely died of this rare skin cancer that came from the toe, not from the bullet.
Jim, we'll take another time out back with more of our conversation on Bob Marley. The Rock and Roll Detective stays with us. Don't go away.
The truth will set you free.
Free.
But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Jim Bergenstadt stays with us. Black Market Beatles, the unreleased recordings of the Beatles, and of course, Nevermind, Nirvana, the Beatle Who Vanished, and Mysteries in the Music, Case Closed. And one of the chapters dedicated to Bob Marley, which is the topic of our conversation on this episode. Before we get back to that, I mentioned the Beatle Who Vanished, and we talked about the drummer who replaced Ringo for a short stint. That is, well, give us an update. You're working on a project regarding that.
So I've recently optioned the book to a London-based independent film company called ECOS. And we just signed the deal. And so the book or the movie is now in development. So it will be a biopic of Jimmy Nichol, but it won't cover just his time, those 2 weeks as a Beatle. It will also cover how did he get to be selected to take over for Ringo in 1964 when Ringo was hospitalized, what it was like on tour in the eye of the Beatlemania hurricane. And then as a 25-year-old, how do you deal with the rest of your life after you've been to the top of the entertainment world? You know, how do you live your life after that? And what do you do? And to me, that's perhaps the most fascinating part of it is that each time he tried something, if it didn't work out, he would just leave. He would just vanish. And he wouldn't tell family or friends or fellow musicians where he went. And he would just go to another country and start all over again. And so I'm on the trail of still trying to locate him. I'm hoping to locate him in time for the 60th anniversary mm-hmm. of his playing with the Beatles, which is this coming June. In the meantime, the film company is in development, which means fundraising and hiring a screenwriter to work on the script. And I'll be serving as both an executive producer and a script consultant.
And you're also serving as an historical consultant on a new rock documentary called If These Walls Could Rock. Great title. What's this all about?
Yeah. Well, it's based on a book of the same name, and it's about a really interesting Los Angeles hotel called the Sunset Marquis. And for many years, a lot of musicians and actors and artists of all kind, authors, have stayed there, and many interesting things have taken place there. There are a lot of great stories that we've dug up, and then, of course, a lot of people will be interviewed who actually lived there. So, for example, Ozzy Osbourne and his family lived there when they moved from England for several years before they got a house. Bruce Springsteen lived there for whenever he was in Los Angeles working on an album, before he bought a California home. So a lot of people actually lived there because there are some villas and, so they're fully like apartments. So a lot of interesting people have been able to come together. So there are stories, for example, of collaboration or a love story or a jam session, things like that, that we're working on.
Fantastic. Do we have a release date approximately?
No, I think right now we're, Tyler Meesom, the director, is interviewing various artists. And I would say these are A and B level artists, pretty high up the food chain of rock and roll and pop music. And the issue is, when they're in LA, can he catch them? If they're on tour, do they want to take the time from the tour? So there's a lot of scheduling issues with these people. So I think interviews will probably run through the end of summer, early fall. And then there's all the post-production work, putting it together. So my guess is it would be on one of the streaming networks probably by sometime next year.
All right. Fantastic. Looking forward to both the projects, the documentary, If These Walls Could Rock, the 60th anniversary update on the Beatle Who Vanished with Jimmy Nichols, the June 64 tour, and also the movie based on the book, The Beatle Who Vanished. All right, let's get back to Bob Marley for a few minutes. So the assassination attempt, he survives, performs at Smile Jamaica with a bullet still lodged in his elbow. Had Marley actually come out and endorsed, I mean, what kind of impact did he have? What kind of influence? Do you think he had the power to swing an election with an endorsement, which he never gave, but did he have that kind of influence?
He did have that kind of influence. In fact, the fact that he survived that shooting and then had the courage to go out on stage and perform that night. And if people want, they can probably locate that. A bootleg of that concert, I believe, is on YouTube, and it's just type in Bob Marley, Smile Jamaica, and you'll find it. It's as if he became lionized as some sort of deity to all of the people of Jamaica at that point. And so if he had just said on stage, you know, I think you ought to vote for Prime Minister Manley or Edward Siega, that's what they would have done. But he never did take a position. And in fact, he went off to England for a couple of years. And about 2 years later, he came back home. And he actually brought these two political candidates who represented these gangs, too. He brought them together on stage for another peaceful concert. But they all had their arms around each other. And he showed that people could, you know, live in peace together. So he was a neutral, very neutral, and for good reason.
Just spend a few minutes and talk to me about Marley's lifestyle. I mean, he was not interested in, you know, fancy cars or a big house. I'd read a report once where he preferred to sleep on the floor. I don't know if that's true.
Well, I think he lived quite frugally, and his concern was not how much money can I accumulate, how many, you know, cars and whatever, jets, as you see nowadays. It was, do I have enough money to feed my family and to feed all the families of my band members? You know, that was also like a second family to him, the Wailers. And I think he wasn't concerned with, you know, gold records and that sort of thing. In fact, there's a great scene in the film where he's in London and he's finished this new album, which is probably considered his best album ever. It's called Exodus. Mm. And he shows the cover to the marketing person at the record label, and the marketing person, and it just says Exodus and then Bob Marley and the Wailers. And the marketing guy goes, "We got to have your face on the cover, Bob." And Bob's like, no, man, it'll sell. It'll be fine, you know. And he just didn't think that was an important thing. He's just such a great person, and he just cared about family and his spirituality. And what's funny is there's another scene after the album does really well where the marketing guy is shown the gold record on the wall, and he's like, yeah, okay, I was wrong. But he was a frugal person and lived quite simply.
So the cancer that started, I guess, in the big toe, was that related to maybe a soccer injury, a football injury?
As I understand, well, first of all, we should mention that there was a second alleged attempt on his life, a conspiracy theory, while he was waiting to decide whether to go to the concert. And according to these people who weren't there at the retreat where he was hiding, claim that Carl Colby gave him a pair of soccer shoes as a gift.
Right.
And they had a copper wire in them, which gave him the cancer. Well, and I go through in the book all the scientific reasons why that's not possible. Also, Jeff Walker, again, was attached to Carl Colby every minute of the day. He said not only did Carl not give him shoes or a gift, nobody got near him and gave him any sort of gift. But as to your question, there was a rare form of skin cancer that ran in his family background that was discovered years later. And it's possible that his soccer playing exacerbated the problem of the cancer. And again, he did ignore it for quite a while until he finally was sent to a doctor. And then that was in England. And he was told he had cancer. And again, he sort of sat on that information and kept going. I think two of his concerns were, if I have to have my big toe taken off to save this cancer, number one, it violates sort of my religious beliefs. And number two, it will affect my dancing on stage. And number three, it'll affect my ability to play soccer. And those are all three things that were extremely important to him. And he did that later go to Miami, where a portion of the toe was cut off, but that unfortunately was not enough to stop the cancer from spreading ultimately throughout his whole body. And perhaps he could have saved his life had he taken the whole toe off.
He was in Europe. Was he in Germany seeking treatment at some point?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I think after it got quite bad, he went to a specialty place in Germany that was trying all types of new methods to see if they could stop the cancer. But I think that, as I recall, what happened was once the cancer travels up to your organs and later your brain, that, you know, it's over.
Right, right. And he intended to get back to Jamaica, but I guess they had to stop in Miami. He was too sick to get to Jamaica.
I think that's right.
And that's where he passed away, in Miami?
Passed away, yeah. Hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Bob Marley, I think he had something like 12 children. Are they all, they're all involved in the music industry, are they? Or
I think they're in different ways. I mean, I think that a lot of them are helping with the family legacy business. In fact, I noticed in the credits of the movie when I watched it, the One Love film, was that a lot of them are named with various functions in the film. I think Ziggy Marley was an executive producer, and in fact, he introduces the movie. And at the end, also, I think Stephen Marley was the music supervisor. But, you know, there's also merchandise. There's so many aspects of running a family legacy business. And I believe that several of the family members seem to be regularly involved in that.
So ultimately, what is Bob Marley's legacy?
Well, I think it's about spirituality. I think it's about social justice for people to be able to live a good life, to have food, to be able to work, to be able to send their kids to school. Spirituality was very important to him. And he spoke about these things in his music, in the lyrics. And he fought for what he thought was right through his music. And I think that it has, it's a music that continues to live on. And just as the Beatles music keeps going on and on to future generations, I think Bob Marley's music will continue to resonate to future generations for both the beauty of the music and as well as the importance of his lyrics.
The Rock and Roll Detective, Jim Birkenstad. Mysteries in the Music, Case Closed. The Beatle Who Vanished, Black Market Beatles, and Nevermind, Nirvana, all available at Amazon. And through the website as well, are they?
TheBeatleWhoVanished.com. It has signed copies are available, and MusicMysteryBook.com. They can get signed copies of Mysteries in the Music.
Fantastic. The rest,
but they're all available at Amazon worldwide.
Fantastic. Jim, best wishes for future successes. Can't wait for the new projects to come to fruition. And great talking to you again, as always.
Thank you very much for having me on, Richard. It was a real pleasure.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.